vacuum on at 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. Vacuum on at 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Zero, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world today. My name is Grant Cameron, and I have one of my favorite guests on. I say there are maybe a dozen really good stories in ufology, and this is one of them. Today, I introduce to you Nancy Tremaine, sometimes known as Nancy Drew Tremaine, and we'll get into that. One of the few people who actually investigated her own case, wrote her own books, and documented her story. She's done two books. One was called Symbiosis, which I helped her publish, and the new one that she has is Enlightened, and it is actually a recreation of a second book that she did. So she's got two books on internet on Amazon.com. If you go to Nancy Tremaine, Amazon.com, you'll see her two books. And I believe there may be a third in the work, but we'll talk about that. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you doing today?
I'm wonderful. And thank you for having me.
Beautiful. You look good. You're one of the people that looks like 20 years younger than you actually are.
It's the lighting and the makeup, believe me.
My lighting and the makeup. Super. Well, wonderful. So let me start. You wanted to start with something. So let's go through what you want to start with, and then we'll get into your story. And I just basically want you to tell it like you would tell it, say, to your children or your grandchildren, or, you know, to record your story of what happened. Because this is an incredible story that has gone on most of your life. And it's a story I think everybody should hear because it's extremely important. So go ahead.
Okay. And of course, I have notes because we're talking about 60 years now. So I wanted to address something before I begin talking about the 61 event that I should have talked about just a long time ago. I want to start by addressing all the experiencers that have been brave enough to share their stories, knowing there was nothing to gain and everything to lose. Many of us bare our souls and spill our guts to be judged, ridiculed, silenced, and dismissed. I kept my story a secret for 50 years, and when I did share it, September 1st of 2011, with a former state MUFON director, Dr. Harry Wilness, he told me there would be a problem because it was in July of 1961, 2 months before Betty and Barty Hill. That had never entered my mind. He said I would be challenged. I didn't want to be challenged. I wanted and needed to be heard and to share. I can't tell you how many times that date was questioned. I was positive, I was sure. I had drawn a picture of that ship, that tree, the police, the beam of light for 50 years. And every, at the end of every one, at the top of every illustration, I would write the words, the summer of 1961. And then I would discard it, but I did that for my sanity. Even though the date is in my books, I never brought attention to it, and neither did one person who interviewed me. I was made to feel like I would be somehow taking away from Betty and Barney Hill. I actually felt guilty. Then I realized I had been made to cover up the truth. This is called gaslighting. People that interview me were contributing to it. I had reached out to MUFON, the Novi, Michigan historian, and I finally got the Detroit Historical Society to do an interview with Police Chief Lee Begall and I in 2017. They still haven't released it. because they think it would hurt Chief Bagall's stellar reputation. He wanted that interview. He needed it as much as I did. He allowed me to record our conversations for over 6 years. I was made to tout my truth, my sanity. I even met a MUFON historian researcher twice. I also talked with the Novi, Michigan historian per request of Chief Bagall. She was actually at his house and he said, "It's Nancy Tremaine, the lady I told you about. Please talk to her." Well, I'm glad I recorded that because she didn't want to hear one word of it. Because again, this would take away from Chief Bagall's stellar reputation. And I think she thought I was crazy. This is the job of an historian. Their job is to preserve, to collect, to research and interpret historical information to help future generations. Bagall wanted to speak. The fact that they all stayed silent speaks volumes to me. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for Grant Cameron, who I have dubbed Sir Grant. If anyone deserves that title, it is him. He published my first book and asked for nothing in return. He heard me, he believed me, and everyone loves him. He is the most respected man in the field of ufology. Since my speech in Ozark 2018, I have never been asked to speak again, even though I received an overwhelming standing ovation and nearly 100,000 views. My 10 years of Nancy Drew research brought forth witnesses, newspaper articles, and the military investigation. I was finally recognized on May 12th, 2021, just last month, by Coast to Coast Fade to Black Jimmy Church. In fact, it was the first thing he pointed out, acknowledging me, stating, "It's in the book." He could never realize how much that meant to me. It is a fact that the field of ufology and MUFON has become a money-making industry filled with egos. Facts are overlooked. Many experiencers are not being heard because they don't have the money to write books, make audios, or travel to these conventions. So it's always the same faces in the same places. It reminds me of how the popular group separated themselves from the rest of the classmates in school. I was naive, believing I would be welcomed into this field, only to see and find out that this is a competition. I've left this field many times, but I always come back. I continue to fight for Cindy, police chief, and all the other citizens of Novi, Michigan that witnessed or lived this event. They need and deserve to be heard and validated. I will continue to share my ongoing chapters of my life from 2011 to present. I continue to live in this phenomenon of undeniable, unavoidable, unavoidable, remarkable, increased synchronicities. These include samadhi, sleep writing, necromancy, visions, and love. That's it. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you for the kind words. I can back up your statement about the Ozark. And I've told you this story before. You tried to get your book published. They wouldn't publish your book. And I remember at the end, I told you the story when you got the standing ovation. Most of the people in the room were crying, including me. It was a very moving speech. And I remember one of the people who didn't publish her book came up to me as she was leaving and said, "I'm glad you helped her. We made a big mistake." And they acknowledged the fact that they should have published your book. It's an incredible story. You have an incredible, another thing I don't know if I ever told you, you have an incredible voice. I think you should be reading children's books. You have an incredible way of talking and reading. And I think that was the powerful thing. And I will do what I can to make sure you get into other conferences. That is a problem we've had and we still have. If you know the whole story about now we have this big disclosure thing, all the news articles. But if you take a look what they're doing, Nancy, what you're seeing them doing is they're saying, We're going to talk about threat. We're going to talk about potential threat. We're going to talk about interference with military equipment. We want to talk about Russia. We want to talk about China, but we're not going to talk. Nobody talks about aliens. We're not using the word aliens. And what has happened is the experiences have been cut out. They don't want to hear the experiences. They want to talk about threats. They want to talk about getting money for military and for weapons and stuff like that. And even now, no experiencers are allowed to talk in this present disclosure thing. And I hope you can join me on on June the 25th. I'm going to have an event where the experiencers will tell their side of the story. So the government may come out with their little thing about how this is a threat to the military or whatever they're going to say. And we don't know what this is and we need money or whatever. But on the 25th, I'm going to have all the experiencers join online and they're going to say what the intelligence behind this phenomena wants people to know, because the experiences have been silenced for a long time. I've said that, and I've said over and over again, until you talk to the people who are interacting with the phenomena, you are never going to learn what's going on. You cannot learn by watching a light in the sky or by taking films. It's only when you talk to people like you and some of the other people that have come forward and been brave enough to write books and to basically, you know, take a lot of interference from family and from friends and stuff like that. So I applaud you for coming forward and for doing it. And especially, as I mentioned in the opening, for somebody who actually went and actually did all the research, you got the regression set up, you did all the interviews. So let me start with the first question. You've got a lot of material. You've got a lot of tapes. You've got a lot of stuff. And you've recorded for history. That's what I say that I want to do, is you just simply record. That's why I wanted to get your book out there, is because I tell experiencers, have you ever written this down? And they'll say, well, I thought about it. And I say, you should write it down for history. You are in the biggest story of all times. You have been chosen. You probably came into this world and agreed to whatever it is that's going on here. Write the story down. So what are you going to do with all your material when you have to leave the world? Have you got a place where you're going to send it?
Well, I would love to get all of these recordings to you. Jeff Dimmers has a lot of them right now, and he's cleaned them up. He's the one who published Enlightened.
Yeah.
And he's cleaned up the background noise. Some of them, you know, like my regressions really need to be cleaned up. The first regression wasn't recorded. Cindy's regression is clear. And anything that I have transcribed in the book, I have the recordings to. Everything. Anything that I say in the books is a fact and can be backed up. And I want that known. And I would love to send all of those recordings to you. I'll have Jeff do that when he cleans them up. And
Would you like them to be public in terms of being online where people, because that's what I have. You know, I have a podcast. And what I do in the podcast, I go every day on a podcast and I put up various stories. Stuff that people, because I've never heard your regression tapes, and maybe we can talk a little bit about what's in them, because that is where you get to the actual truth of the matter, is when the person is under regression and they're telling the story, a story that even they don't remember, but now they're telling the story. So how long are the regressions? Are we talking hours of tape?
About an hour, maybe a little bit longer on each one, but Cindy only had one regression.
Okay.
I only had five in a very short period of time. In fact, after the third regression, it was like Pandora's box opened. I was given, and I was told, they were going to return my memories of what happened on that ship, and that's exactly what they did, and that's how it's written in the book.
What we can also do is if I get the things, we can send them to Rice University in Texas. That's where Jacques Vallée's files are going. That's where Whitley Strieber's files are going. That's where Clifford Stone's files are going, Paula Harris's files are going, to put them a record for people to go. Now, a lot of people don't go to archives, and they don't, because it's like you know. I mean, how many people actually go and investigate their own case? How many people did the work that you did? Most people, they think, well, if it's in the archives, but you recorded for history. But a lot of people aren't going to go to Rice University to hear it. That's why I try to put as much as I can online, because people, that's what they do. They're online now. They're on the computer. But to collect it, we can maybe make sure that Rice University gets them. And you'll be with the collections of Whitley Strieber and Jacques Vallée. And the guy that is one of the religion professors there understands the experiencer thing. So you get, Whitley Strieber says the same thing you said. And I don't know if Whitley contacted you. I said to Whitley, you need to interview Nancy, and he's going to reach out to you. But he had the same thing. He said his life was totally ruined by this thing. Like, he's basically, everybody thinks he's a rich guy. He said he's not a rich guy at all. He went sort of like into bankruptcy. He had a very tough time. So that's where I think the world, maybe, as I said to, if you know, I was good friends with Angela Joyner, who lost her job by doing the Stevensville story in 2008. And I said to her, you may have lost your job. You may have a real bad time in this life, but 500 years from now, your great, great, great grandchildren will say, that was my relative. And you will be recorded as being someone who stood out. It's almost like we're living at the time of the Jesus or at the time of the signing of the Constitution, that people don't realize how important it is, their story, in terms of what it is. So let's see what we can do about that. Because your story is incredible. And it starts in your books, you start back when you're 12. But let me ask you, was there anything before you were 12? Like, in terms of, a lot of people when they go back will describe, oh, now I remember something when it happened was a kid. Did you have anything mm-hmm. before 12? Tell yes. me about that.
My very first event was when I was 2 or 3 years old. And that was through regression. And I drew a picture of it. It's in the first book, Symbiosis, of what I was shown. And that was the only time that I've ever seen Mr. in reptilian form. That was the only time.
Wow.
And as a child, it was creepy. And he could feel what I was feeling. And I was thinking icky. And yeah. That was my word at 2 or 3 years old. And so he has never shown me that form since. It's now just light knowledge energy. So
describe Mr. for people who don't know who he is, because he's the main character of your experience.
You mean if in reptilian form? How?
Well, in all of the things, just describe, you know, because you saw him as a human being and then you saw yes. him in this vision as reptilian. So describe to people who he was and how he fits into the story.
Well, at 2 or 3 when I saw him, he was in reptilian form. He was very tall. 7-8 feet tall, greenish brown, and I said he had alligator feet. And David Chase did a beautiful drawing of him, and he was wearing a hooded cape. And what creeped me out were the scales, because they were moving on his face, and I could see the. Even now, anything that has to do with the scales just gives me the creeps.
Yeah.
Then in 1961, when he was the pilot on board ship, and I'll get to that, he was in human form. He looked just like anybody's father. At 12 years old, you know, you all old men look alike. And then in 2015, he was in energy form of his size and shape, but he was in the form of energy.
Wow.
And now he is just a message, a vision, a thought. I'm led to the computer. There are so many ways that I communicate with them, and through necromancy, which is talking with the dead, past lives, visions, and just a knowing. I'll wake up and I'll know things that I didn't know. I didn't learn, and I just know.
Yeah.
So it was dropped in. And I say that we are the Google to them.
Yeah.
By that I mean that it's like they can surf the web through us. They can shut us down. They can store information.
Wow.
They can download information.
Why do you call him Mister?
Because, well, I'll get to that. When I was on board ship and at 12 years old, I said I couldn't believe that I was on a flying saucer. And he said, this is a ship. And I realized that we were communicating with feelings and telepathy. I could feel what he was feeling about me. He thought, oh, that's cute. She's so naive. And he said, it's a ship. And I remember I was, I put my hands on my hips and I said, Mister, this can't be a ship because a ship goes in the water and a ship is what is Captain Hook was on. And he said, oh, but this does go in the water. That's how we got the name Mister.
Wow. That's fascinating. So can you describe, let's go through maybe start with the 2012. And the one thing I don't recall you talking about is what the ship looked like inside in terms of.
Oh, yes.
And there was other beings there as well. There was, and you did have the incident with the Greys where you go back to Mr. later on and ask him, why did you allow this to happen?
Yes.
Tell us the 2012 story about, and it is important to for history to record here.
This is 1961.
And so this is 2 months before Betty and Barney Hill. So yes. When the history gets properly recorded, you will be the first. You will be, and so that makes it very important because it's a different type of experience than Betty and Barney Hill had. But yes, it is an important experience being the first. So go ahead.
And this is why I've made notes, because I'll do an interview and I'll go, oh, you left this out and you left that out. I want the complete event. So if you see me reading my own notes, I'm sorry, but I want you to hear everything that happened.
That is important, because that's what I said. Like, yeah, you have a lot of tapes and you have a lot of, you must write all day long. You must be recording all day long. So you have an incredible collection, which I think is valuable to save. To make sure that especially if you were sort of the first, that it gets recorded and everything gets, you're documenting it and that gets saved so it doesn't get lost once you leave the planet.
Thank you. Just thank you for this opportunity too. And every few minutes I might have to take
This is just like a conversation like we would talk, because a lot of times it's sort of very formal. But I want it to be just a conversation where you just sort of tell the story for history, because you've told it to me numerous times before. We've had interviews before. And
so much has been left out. Yes.
Yeah. So go ahead and read your notes. Do whatever you have to do to make sure your story gets done accurately. You're very accurate in terms of making sure. That's what another thing we should point out is that you didn't leave any stone unturned. If somebody didn't talk to you, you kept going until they talked to you. So you don't really leave stuff out. You don't really skip things. You don't really say, we'll worry about that later. You've got everything recorded, everything written down, and everybody gets to talk and nobody gets to sort of avoid.
And I'm really excited to bring this up, because this just happened yesterday. I was directed to, I did an interview with the Detroit News in 2014. And this is odd. The newspaper reporter's name was Lonnie, H-U-H-M-A-N, but it was pronounced human.
Okay.
Human. And after the interview, he got emails and he forwarded them to me. And one was especially, I didn't realize how important it was until about a week ago. And then yesterday it really kicked in. This email came from a woman who's 2 years older than me. So she was 14 at the time.
Okay.
She wrote, I want to remain anonymous. I will only talk with Nancy Tremaine. It was the summer of 1961. I had an incident, not quite as dramatic as hers, but I would like to share it with Nancy. And she did. We talked on the phone twice and I forgot all about her until about a week ago. And I'm like, wait a minute. So I found her old email and I saw that, her name is Dorothy. Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. And I always say, you can't make this stuff up. And it hit me today when I went and found her old email.
Yeah.
And I looked at her name and I said, Dorothy. And then I looked up the meaning of the name Dorothy, and it's a gift from God. And I think that I sent her an email yesterday and I said, I'd like to talk to you again. So I'm excitedly waiting for her. Okay, I'll start with the event, and this is 1961. Now, I was born in Detroit in 1949, but I grew up in the rural village of Novi, Michigan. I'm a country girl. I'm still a country girl. I live in the middle of nowhere now. My father was an aerospace he was a hydraulic engineer in the aerospace division of, it was Speary Vickers at the time in Troy, Michigan. And my mother was a stay-at-home mother until that summer of 1961, she took a job, part-time job, working from 5 to 9 p.m., 3 days a week, at a market 2 or 3 miles down the road. My girlfriend and I were 12 years old, and it was summer vacation, and we would be starting junior high in September, so we were excited about that. And our story begins July of 1961, between the hours of 6.05 p.m. when my dad got home from work, until 10 minutes to 9 when I was returned home. Now, I had a curfew, 7:30, and I had to be home. It was mandatory. You know, my father was one to give spankings very often. So I was an hour and 20 minutes late getting home. But Cindy's house was across, there's a perfect view from my house to her house. The weather was beautiful that early evening, but we decided to play inside the house. And we heard her father holler for us to come outside, and we could hear the urgency in his voice, and we ran for that front door. We never could have imagined that our lives were going to be changed forever. There was a large silver flying saucer. It was breathtakingly beautiful, and it lit up with a large belt of red, green, and white lights that were pulsating or rotating. They were going so fast. There was no sound, and it was hovering between a tree between our two homes. And I always use these words when I describe how I felt when I walked out that front door. It was like when Dorothy walked out the door, Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, when the movie goes from black and white to color. It was surreal. It was like I was in a dream. I remember I was willing it to stay there. I kept in my mind saying to it, stay there, because I wanted everybody to see it. Because I wanted to know that I wasn't crazy. I was really seeing this. Cindy's father was adjusting a small tripod telescope. And he asked us if we wanted to look through it. And of course I said no, because the ship was literally right in front of us. I mean, it was right in front of us. And I wonder now what he could have been seeing through that telescope. Cindy's sister, brother, and a few neighbors had stepped outside their doors. You could see them. Novi was so unpopulated at the time, it was still a village. And there were no sounds. The closest neighbor to Cindy's house came out with his two young boys. Cindy remembered that clearly too. And the only sound that was heard was an approaching Novi, Michigan police car as it coasted to a stop in front of where we were all standing. And the two officers got out of their car and they walked with their backs towards us. They never took their eyes off the ship. But I was thrilled that these police officers were there because this was validation. That was really cool. I grabbed one of the officer's arms, and this really stands out. Grabbed him by the arm, and I tried to voice three simple words. And they came out in slow motion and deep. My voice was really deep, and I said, "Is this real?" And he never said a word. I took mental pictures of the beauty of this ship against the clear blue sky. It was an overload of visual stimulation. Then we all watched as a car started coming down Meadowbrook Road. Now, Meadowbrook Road is the road that my home was on. Seventh house on the left from 10 Mile Road. And was driving towards us. And the tree and the ship are here, and the car is coming, putting itself closer and closer to the ship. And I'm thinking, my God, who is crazy enough in this car to be putting themselves closer to this ship? Fifty years later, I would find out who it was. It was Deputy Officer Martin Cohn in an unmarked car patrolling a nearby area under construction. I would also learn that he had called Police Chief Liebigall at the police station, which was a couple miles away, on the two-way radio. That's what they used back in 1961. And he said, strange object overhead, Sindh cars. And later on, when I talked to Chief Begal, he said, I thought to myself, what is wrong with that man? He said, but we did take action. And we watched as a beam of light came out of the bottom left-hand side of the ship, and it was aimed at the car. And it was working its way very slowly. You know, we were watching this light. We're all wondering what's going to happen when it hits the car. And when it hit the hood of the car was immobilized. Now, this is the point where I started jumping up and down, like doing jumping jacks, and I'm yelling, over here, over here. I thought, well, maybe I was hysterical. I don't know. But the ship heard me. And Cindy was grabbing me by the arm, and she was yelling at me, stop it, stop it. But the ship heard me, and it tilted on its side like this. And it said, we see you. And I knew it was alive. I knew this ship was alive. And that scared the hell out of me. I grabbed the same police officer's arm and I said, do something. And when he looked down at me, it was the very first time I'd ever seen fear in a man's face. So that was really a defining moment for me. I thought I'd never feel safe in this world again. And then missing time. Now I'm at home with my dad and he's holding me. He's telling me he loves me and that I'm home and that I'm safe. And the kitchen door's open and I can see outside, and it's getting dark outside. And we had this, we were right in front of the stove in the kitchen, and I could see that it was 10 minutes to nine. Notice I don't say 9:50 because at 12 years old, it was 10 minutes to nine. And my dad wasn't spanking me. He was just thrilled to have me home. And I remember asking him if I could call mom at work. I really wanted to call mom at work, and he said it was okay. And I remember she was so calm, and I was so excited telling her about this beautiful ship, whatever I told her. She said, I get off in 10 minutes and I'll be home at 10 after nine. That was 20 minutes and I needed my mother then. And I didn't understand. And she said there were so many customers that had come into the store and told her about that ship. And I didn't understand why she didn't come home. I didn't understand. Of course, now I realize that Dad, of course, never told her. That I had been missing. And my dad shared a secret with me. And I leave this out a lot because I say things and people, oh. But he told me about an alien that had been captured by the government and it had been nicknamed Skinny Bob. This isn't Skinny Bob. I have to add a little humor here. But I remember my dad used the word captured and Skinny Bob, and I remember that really made me mad. That
at the same time? or later? Did he tell you that?
Right when I got home. Wow. Yeah, that night. Okay. And he told me that this was between us, not even to be shared with my mother. I didn't understand why this whole thing and everything that had happened was to be shut down, the end, not to talk about it again. But I realize now that the reason my dad told me about Skinny Bob was because it was validating information that would be important to me in the future when I could talk about it 50 years later. So I thank my dad for that.
Do you think that he saw something, or do you think he had some experience or was involved?
Yes. Wow. Well, yes, and that's coming up because, Okay. Yeah, he had to have known I was on that ship, and he had to have known that I needed that information. It was easy for me to be silent and keep a secret because I now realize that I was programmed to remove the details of what had happened, only to remember that ship, the police, the light, the tree. And Cindy was programmed also, and so was former police chief Lee Begall. We all remembered the ship, but the details didn't come forward for 50 years. And it's ironic that the three of us all awakened within a 1 month period after 50 years. We all awakened and the memory started coming back to us. But that night when I went to bed, I remember standing on the headboard of my bed, looking out of my bedroom window at the spot above the tree where that ship had hovered. And I would chant over and over again, please come back and get me. I really wanted that ship to come back and get me. So the feelings that they left me with must have been so loving and positive that a 12-year-old child was willing to leave her mother and father to be with them. I stored the memories of what I had in the back of my mind where no one could get them. And Cindy and I started seventh grade in September. Now, what I'm about to share, I've never shared before because I was embarrassed.
You're doing a good job.
I was held back that year. I had to do seventh grade over because I was an angry child filled with rage due to emotional problems. Okay. Cindy and I grew apart over the next 50 years. And between the two of us, we were married seven times. I was the four, she was the three. I went to several therapists over the years, telling them that I needed to be hypnotized, because it was the only word I knew. And I knew that the answers were inside. I didn't know that the answers had to do with this experience, but I knew that there was something inside me that had to come out. And the only way that they were gonna come out was to be hypnotized. Not one therapist would do it. It was drug after drug, diagnosis after diagnosis. But every year or so, I would get this burning sensation to my nose. And I knew that that burning smell that I would get was attached to the memories. So every time it would come, I'd say, okay, I'm gonna grab the memories this time. And I would try to grab them, but I couldn't. But I found out 50 years later what the burning smell was attached to the memories. It was ozone, electromagnetism, attached to the ship. Cindy re-entered my life many times over the next 50 years, and our secret was the glue that bonded us together. Only once in all those years did she ever answer my question. I would start to say, Cindy, can we? And she knew. That was what I got. But one time she said, I said, please just tell me that it happened. It, I didn't say what it was. I just said, just tell me it happened. And she said, it happened. And I don't want to talk about it. And apparently neither did I, because it was dropped. My life was very wild. Bars, men, dangerous men, mafia. I sat at the table many times with Jimmy Hoffa, who was at the table. I was young. I was 21. I was beautiful. And these were powerful men. And I ended up dating, if you want to call it dating, one of them. I won't say his name because he has family that's still alive. But these were powerful men. And I remember I went with them to the racetrack one time. This is something I've never shared either. Me and like six of these mafia people. And we were at a big table and they were laughing. They had found so much humor in how naive I was. And they gave me 10 $100 bills. And they told me to go up to the window and bet on the horses. And I said, I don't know. I had no idea what to do or how to bet. And I wanted to pocket the money. I'll tell you, I did not want to go up to that window. Anyways, I ended up losing $1,000. And they all laughed. It was all a big joke because money meant nothing to these people. So that was my life. It was also filled with panic attacks, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, which I still suffer with. And I want everybody to know that I suffer with this stuff, not because of my experiences, but because of humanity.
One thing we should maybe mention is that you were also a track runner. That was part of the story. You were a track runner, right?
Oh, yes, I was a track runner.
So tell that story, because that was, yeah. Don't realize that was part of the story with the flying saucer.
Yes. In 2015, I was a cheerleader also for years, and I was in track, and nobody could beat me. And we had this Oakland County get-together where the best of the best were to compete. And I didn't know how anything to do but run. So I did the 50-yard dash, took first place, 75 little hurdles, took first place. And we're talking, I was tiny. Some of these girls were big, tall. Yeah. And then I was chosen to take the baton home. And I still remember it like it was yesterday, because I would bite my bottom lip and haul ass. And I took that baton and made up for any lost time. And I ended up getting a trophy and 3 gold medals. And we'll get to where that comes in there. Cindy's life was filled with, hardcore alcoholic, addicted to those machines in the bars, you know, those machines in the bars. You couldn't get her off. In fact, they would place a cup on the handle for her because she'd put so much money in. And they were going to close. And they'd say, okay, the cup's on the handle, it's yours tomorrow. And there were times when she would lose her husband's entire paycheck. And there were times she would win big. So she threatened to commit suicide so many times. And she was... put in the hospital. Many times for trying to commit suicide. Anyways, let's fast forward here to September 1st of 2011, and I'm playing on the computer. And I see the word ufologist, UFOologist, a word I'd never heard or seen. And it was also next to the word MUFON, something else I'd never heard. And this man was a former state director of MUFON, Dr. Harry Wellness. So I sent him an email. And I said, I might have something you'd be interested in hearing. And he got back to me immediately. And I remember I was sitting right on my back patio. And he asked me to tell him what I'd seen. And at first I said, tell me all about it. I said, I can't do that. It's been 50 years. And the next thing I know, I told him everything I could remember. So we made plans to meet just a couple days later and at a bar. And he came armed, and I have to laugh here because he only had one arm. He came armed with my sick sense of humor. He came armed with books and pictures of the aliens. And he wanted me to look at these aliens, and not one of them stirred any emotion in me. I thought they were silly looking.
Yeah.
He asked if I could draw a picture of the ship. And I said, are you kidding? I can draw a picture of that ship, the police, the beam of light, that tree, everything. And boom, there it was. And he was impressed. And like I said, I drew a picture of it every year or two. And I would quickly discard it. And I did that for my sanity. Now, Dr. Wellness asked me if I wondered what had happened during that, why it was dark when I got home. And I wondered, but it never had entered my mind. I never could even go there. You know what I'm saying? I couldn't even go there or even think about what happened. But he found a regression therapist. And we all got together at Harry Wellness's house on September 11th, 2001. So things were moving really quick. If I just awakened in 2001, and this is now 10 days later, and I felt really comfortable with Vaughn. He was very, I wanted this remission so bad. I was ready. Let's just do it. But Dr. Wellness was worried because I'd been molested twice, and he was afraid that the regressions might do more harm than good. And I had been molested by my sister's husband when I was 14. And I had been molested by my gynecologist, my 6-week checkup. These are things that I haven't talked about either. They're in the first book, though, by my gynecologist at my 6-week checkup. I was 17 years old. So he was, of course, concerned that it might do more harm than good. But we did the first regression at Dr. Wellness's sister's house, because he wanted me to feel comfortable with him and Vaughn. And I did feel comfortable. I put all my trust in them. I needed answers. I needed to heal. Now, the first and second regressions came in the wrong order. So I'm going to put them in the right order because it's really difficult if I, you know, when you're trying to regress someone, they're going to go where they need to go. And you have to understand that in these regressions, this is 12-year-old Nancy speaking, not me. Vaughn asked me where I am and what I am doing. And I said, I'm jumping up and down. I'm so excited. I want them to see me. I'm doing jumping jacks. I want them to see me. I want to get their attention. Cindy thinks I'm crazy. And Vaughn says, but you're not crazy, are you? And I said, 12-year-old Nancy said, no, I'm brave. And then my tone quickly changes. And I say, it sees us. I know it's going to get me. I'm scared now. I want to hide and there's no place to hide, it's going to get me. And I can run fast. I'm hauling ass. And I know how it's going to get me. And you can hear my breathing getting heavy. And I pause and I say, they got me. And I sound defeated. And I'm frozen in running position with my arms and legs locked. And I'm saying in my head, get Cindy too. Get Cindy too. I don't want to be alone. That's all I could think of was get her too. And then I'm placed on my back and I'm in some beautiful energy wave. And it's euphoric. And there is no fear at this point. I want to stay in this wave forever because it feels good. And Steve Boucher would tell me that I wasn't in a wave, many years later, that I wasn't in a wave, that I was a standing wave. Wow, that was so over my head. But I said in the regression, my body is waving and rumbling. And I'd never used the word rumbling. To the low hum of the ship. And I tell Vaughn, they are waiting for me inside. And Vaughn asked me, what do they want? And I said, they want to see inside me. They want to learn. And the reason they told me that they wanted to see inside me, because I would never have understood a laparoscopy, which is something that didn't even exist until the mid 80s. But it's something where they put the needle in my stomach so that they could view the female organs. And I remember fighting the small grays. There were three small grays and I was fighting like hell. And one of them got up in my face with his eyes and said, we're going to do this procedure. And you're going to get home safely. So I relented at that point. Vaughn asked me, are they doing this with malice? And I was quick to let him know, nope, they're only doing their job. Then after they did that, they placed a smooth metal cylindrical object in my right hand. And I felt that it contained something. I didn't know what, but I knew I was to curl my fingers around it. And the three grays were looking at the wall above me as this, and I called it a rod at the time. It was a rod. And I believe it was a monitor that they were looking at. And I also felt a sense of urgency that they had limited time with me. And today in hindsight, when I look at that illustration that I had drawn of that, I hear their message. Take this baton and run with it. Be an ambassador. So it went from being a rod in my hand to the baton. Beautiful. This is the kind of things that they do.
Beautiful.
That illustration and the baton and me taking that baton and running with it are forever linked. And I believe that I held all of that information inside for 50 years, just like Cindy and Chief Pagal, because they tell me you're exactly where you're supposed to be. I'm always exactly where I'm supposed to be, like right now, doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I tell Vaughn that I'm sitting on the edge of the table and that my legs are dangling over the side now. And the nice one is babying me. And the nice one is a female. She looks like a gray, but she's more human. She has human eyes. And she was very loving, very loving. I just remember she had scraggly hair and awful looking, and she was very tiny. She was like my height.
How could you tell she was a female? Do you, was, was it a sensation, or could you, did they actually have female form?
She was a female. I just knew she was a female. She was mothering and babying me.
Okay.
She was the only female on board.
Okay.
And I tell Vaughn that as the doors slid together, there were two very thick, heavy metal doors, and they slid together. And when they hit, the room became seamless. It was totally seamless. And then the nice one walked me back to the pilot. And I remember I was very angry with him. Very angry. I said, "Mister, why did you let them hurt me?" And I could feel his love. And he said, "Your pain was perceived." He said he wanted me to find the positive in every perception in life. That there is a positive in everything. Everything is a yin and a yang. But I was still pissed at him. The next thing I know, I am standing exactly where I had been taken from, at the exact spot where they took me from, but there's nobody there. I'd been missing for, well, it was 10 to 9 when I got home, so I narrowed it down to an hour and a half, 2 hours, somewhere in there. So there were no police, you know, there were nobody there. Oh, and I jumped over a spot. See, this is what I do. When I first was on the ship, I ran to the windows. Did I talk about that? The large windows?
No, oh.
What we perceive to be the red, white, and green flashing lights from the outside on the inside was perfect. He had a perfect view around him, the gigantic windows, and I had to stand on my toes so that I could see out the window. And I remember I looked out and I could see that we were hovering above the tree, and I could see Mr. Lutz standing there with the telescope. And there was no one. Yeah, it was just Mr. Lutz, and he's like this. And either from the light of the ship or the sun. And I'm yelling, "Mr. Lutz, I'm up here. I'm up here, Mr. Lutz." So I missed that. So and they put me back to, and I'm sorry, I have to jump back to where I had left off. They put me back at the exact spot where they had taken me from, and there was no one there. Mr. Lutz was gone. The telescope was gone. The police car was gone. The neighbors were gone. I was standing in this spot, and I was looking at the ship. And it was just hovering silently. And I watched it. And it went up a little bit like this, just like a little jump. It made this small jump. And then boom. So it was almost like it had to make this little jump start to go. It was unbelievable. So then after that second regression, I became Nancy Drew. And I was out to prove that I wasn't crazy to myself, not just to other people. I had to prove it to myself. So I began my research by going after, and I don't know why I picked him. His name's David Ames. We were never really close friends. We went to junior high and high school together. He lived further up the road from Cindy. And he was on my Facebook list of friends. And I don't know why I chose him. I realize now that everybody that I reach out to is one of the meant to be's. They're placed in my path. And I sent him a letter email with my phone number, asking him to please call me. Well, he called me, and I told him about the incident, and he didn't laugh, or he took it very seriously. He said he wasn't living in Novi at the time, but he said, Nancy, if you want any answers, all you have to do is get a hold of former police chief Lee Begal. He'll have all the answers. So this is where it really gets weird. All I had to do, let me get a drink. All I had to do was go to Google. And you can do that now. All you have to do is Google Police Chief Lee Begal, Novi, Michigan. And you'll find page after page of this guy. And up popped. Now remember, this is 50 years later. Up popped that the following day, they gave me day's notice. The following day, he was to be having a street honored in his name. Now, what are the odds that after 50 years, and this is what happens for so-called hardcore experiencers. I went over to my friend's house, Tom, and I had him help. I didn't have a typewriter. I wanted him to type out a letter that I could give to Chief Begal the following day. And I had told him in the letter about an incident in 1961 in Novi. That had traumatized me. The phone call, I got to the street naming the next day, and I handed him my letter. Now, when I gave him that letter, he knew something was going on with that letter. He held that letter for an hour, and I have a picture of him holding that letter in the book. He never put that letter down for an hour, and they made him. I watched, because he had to go to the podium, and I watched him place it down, and he was watching it. He knew something was in that letter. He called me 2 weeks later. I want to tell you that was the longest 2 weeks of my life. And it was the only phone call, one of the only phone calls. There were a few I didn't record. And I wished I had recorded that one. He started off by saying, thank you for the beautiful letter. And you're not crazy. It really did happen. And so I believe that was Marty Cohn that you saw that ship immobilize. And then he said, he thought to himself, what was wrong with him? But Chief Begal was especially moved by one phone call that he received from a very good friend of his, the former city councilman's wife, Mrs. Don Young. And he said, it was taken very seriously. He said he took phone calls for over 20 minutes from panicked citizens. Now, David Ames comes in play here again. David Ames is the one that I reached out to when he told me to contact Chief Begal. He posted an anonymous post in the, I think it's called Memories of Novi, Northville, Michigan. And the post talked about the flying saucer, and he didn't put my name, but people were quick to respond. One woman said, I remember that. My parents told me not to talk about it too. And another person wrote about an incident that had happened in 1970 in Novi, where the grass had been burned and never grew back. And I found an article in the Novi News Archives, and it was in 1972. It's in the book. There were four witnesses to this daylight sighting. Mrs. Florence McDermott, who was a, Bill McDermott was a good friend of mine. Actually, I think he was a boyfriend for a couple of days. We went to junior high and high school together, and it was his grandmother. He said she never mentioned that. Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah, she never mentioned it. Of course she didn't. You look at the newspaper article. Anyway, the sighting occurred August the 3rd, 1972. While she was outside hanging the laundry, she heard a strange humming sound. She saw an oval object with white lights around it. She said it formed like a halo. She was joined by three neighbors. One was her daughter-in-law. There were four objects in all, in total, and one stopped in midair and made a right angle turn. The report is on file in the Novi Archives. All you have to do is go to the Novi Archives, pull up 1972, read the whole article. Continuing with my Nancy Drew investigation, I decided to go after Cindy. And I had three illustrations at this point. And she was, for Cindy, she was sober when I got to her house. And she saw I was holding illustrations in my hand. And she was happily married at that time. She loved her husband, but they were sleeping in separate bedrooms because he was very sick. He was on oxygen, very, very sick. So they had separate bedrooms. And I asked her if we could go in her bedroom. And I produced illustration after illustration. And she awakened. I actually watched her awakening. Her first remark was, "What are you doing?" And then she said, "It's exactly as I remember it." And her last remark was, "You were gone. We couldn't find you. I think my dad went down to your dad." Now, as she was saying these words, I'm thinking, what the hell? I was gone. So that was a lot she threw at me. And I asked her, "What were the first words? Where did I tell you I'd been when you first saw me?" And she said, "Outer space." Now, those are the words of a 12-year-old. Now, Cindy didn't remember at this point that she had been on board ship. These memories were coming to us over months periods of recorded phone conversations, and we would jar each other's memory. And it was the same with Bagal. After that third regression, after she told me I'd been in outer space, and we were both crying and holding each other. It was a really bonding experience for us because our 50-year secret was done. That 50-year secret was over, and it felt so good. And this is where I remember what I talked about, running past the pilot. And Cindy described the beings as skeletal looking. And she said those bulging eyes, these are, what I'm telling you now are things that I recorded in our conversations. She even used the words frog-like to describe the grays. She remembered being in this clear cylindrical tube above me, suspended. And that was unbelievable because I remembered it. So we both didn't dream the same dream. I had drawn a picture of her in that cylindrical tube, and she remembered. And she remembered watching them doing something to my stomach. And she told Vaughn in her regression that she was afraid that they were going to take her out of the tube and do that to her. But then she said something really odd. She said that I told her that I didn't need her anymore and that I was safe. Now, I never remember telling her that. I still don't remember telling her that, but that's what she said in her regression. And she told Vaughn that she believed she was, she said, I was there because Nancy needed me and I was there because God wanted me to be with her. And that's when I started crying and I had to leave the room. She had her regression done with my regression therapist on my couch, not the one I have now, but I had to leave the room because I realized how much she loved me. When she said those words, she was there because I needed her and because God wanted her to be with me. And Cindy was very religious after that event. She went to that church, and we'll get to that church on the right down the street from my house. Let me have a drink here.
Doing well. You're doing well.
This takes a lot out of you, I tell you.
Yeah.
You know, and people think, oh, it's so easy to talk about. You've done this, you know. You know, I haven't really done it that many times. There are people that do interviews every day. I only do 3 or 4 a year. You know, that's all I can do.
And yet you do well, like the one you did in Eureka Springs. I remember you were there at 7:30. It didn't start till 9:30. You couldn't figure out why they were in the building. Everybody's still sleeping. And you were pretty uptight, but you finished right on time. And as you pointed out, you got a standing ovation. It was incredible for the first time. You're doing well.
In November of 2014, Cindy's husband died. But shortly before his death, he talked Cindy into having that regression. He knew she needed it. And as sick as he was, and he was so sick, he drove all the way here. It was about an hour drive. And he died November of 2014. And 9 months later, Cindy was found dead. 9 months after her one and only regression. She was found dead laying on her kitchen floor where she had laid 2 or 3 days with her dog, Lucy, by her side. And I'm going to interject here. I knew. I had woke up in the middle of the night crying hysterically, but there was no sound coming out. And my throat was so sore. I was crying so hard, and I knew someone I loved had died. And this isn't the first time this has happened to me. I knew someone I loved had died. I went back to sleep, and it was the next day. I was visiting my friend Tom, and I said, "Well, I haven't heard from Cindy for a while. She's probably dead." I was mad at her because I had done a radio interview. I was going to do a radio interview. And she had promised to call Michael Milton, promised me she would call him and tell him about the event. She didn't, and I was really pissed, so I cut her out of my life like cancer. I was pissed. I was punishing her, and she would call and leave message after message. I wish I had saved them, but she was stone drunk, begging me to please answer. She was so sorry. She'd forgotten. Anyway, in her regression, this is important. She talked about a military investigation being done. Now, at that time, I had no idea what a military investigation was. I kind of thought it was crazy. I didn't even want to address it. I didn't want to think about it. But But right after her death, I was walking in the park behind my apartment here, and I was crying and I was angry at her. Damn you. Damn you. I'm all alone now. All alone. You were supposed to be here with me to help me tell my story, our story. We were supposed to tell it together. And she said, and I leave out the first part because it sounds so crazy, but she said, I can help you. Someone has to work from behind the scenes. She said, those men, and then I knew what men she was talking about. A flash came to me of police car driving, escorting a car up my driveway, and my dad telling me to get in my bedroom and shut the door. And I remember hearing a lot of swearing from my dad. So I knew what men she was talking about. She said, they wanted to talk to you. Your father threatened to kill them.
Your father never discussed this with you, correct?
No. We never discussed it. We never discussed it, but we had the closest bond. That was what I think made my relationship with, I'm telling you things now that I've never talked about. That is what I think made my relationship so dysfunctional with my mother was her jealousy of my relationship with my father. I was his favorite. We bonded. He was so protective. You know, I have an older sister I haven't talked to in years. But he was in World War II when I was born. My mother was pregnant for me when he had to go to World War II. I mean for my sister when he had to go to World War II. So he didn't get to meet my sister until she was already walking. So when I was born, I was the only baby girl. And all of his friends said they didn't think I'd ever learn to walk because Dad never put me down. And I can remember always tugging on the leg of his pants. So he carried me everywhere. He carried me on his shoulders. He always carried me. And I remember his smell, his scent, and his whiskers. Dad and I always had that close bond. And my dad was flown to California after this event. And he never went to a business trip. He never went to a business trip, but he was flown to California and he was offered a job position in Australia. And I remember my mom and dad talking about it. And there was no way we were moving. No way. And I remember being taken to stay with strangers. And I remembered their last name, and their last name was Sheehy. And I remembered they had three sons, and I could draw you the whole floor plan of their house. And I just maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I talked to my cousin Marilyn, who is in her 80s. And she's a first cousin on my dad's side. And she said, yes, the Sheehys. You probably were taken to stay with them. It was a payback because Grandma Shinjek, my dad's mother, took care of one of their family members. So that's why I was taken to stay until things cooled down in Novi with these people. And I've tried to find them. I remember one son's name was Rick. He was their oldest son. And I've looked and I don't know how that last name, he could be spelled a million different ways. But I still doing my research, trying to find people. So that was validation again. And while searching through the Novi archives, I struck gold. I mean, I struck gold. Just go to the Novi archives, go to the 1961, and you'll find an article dated August 3rd. And it's almost the full page, and it's in the book, first book. And it's written by the minister down the road where Cindy always went to church. And I only went to church with her when they had special events going on, like dances or parties. The sermon was titled The Martian Question. The Martian Question. It was the only relief given to the citizens of Novi that were forced to suffer in silence. And he wrote, and you'll love the article he wrote. And there's two Martians in this picture. He's got, one of them's got an antenna coming out of his head, and the other one's holding a ray gun. And he wrote that he hoped these beings from Mars would be benevolent, friendly believers of God. He said, next Sunday in this world, can you even imagine a sermon today being titled The Martian Question? So I could point out more synchronicities. This is what happens when you become a hardcore experiencer. Cindy ended up marrying police officer Warren Faulkner, who was on duty, his younger brother. She married Warren Faulkner, who was the younger brother of Dick Faulkner, who I believe was the officer whose arm I tugged and said, is this real? So that was her first husband, was his younger brother. He turned FBI. And I did try to get him to speak at Chief Pagal's 95th birthday party. And he turned and walked away. He's still alive. He's, 12, 13 years older than me. I don't know. He's like 85, 86. I saw him. Anyway, I'll talk about that as I get later on. I saw him again not too long ago. But I told Police Chief Gall, I said, Faulkner wouldn't talk about it. And he said, well, it's probably because the government told him he's not supposed to talk about it. Got that recorded too. So after Cindy's death, Police Chief Liebegall was all I had left, and I clung to him. I mean, that poor guy, I clung to him like a life preserver for my life. He is the bravest man I have ever known for daring to put his stellar reputation on the line. He said, and I want to quote him, I have the recording, I want to speak out not just for you, Nancy, but for all the citizens of Novi that suffered in silence. End quote. He even offered to speak with my daughter and my grandchildren. He was very concerned about them not talking to me. He loved me. He spoke freely, openly, and honestly about that military investigation. In fact, he called it, and I did a full military investigation. I still don't know what a full military investigation is, but that must be a really good military investigation. So it's on record somewhere and all, but somebody's got to do it's fine because it's there. Okay. Until I get a little cocky when I get he said they came from the Air Force. They came from New Mexico or Arizona, and they came in prepared to disbelieve everyone because things like that don't happen. But they do happen like that, don't they, Nancy? Got that recorded too. Said they knew how to talk. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, they knew what to say to jog my memory. Now, the definition of the word jog is to push or nudge. So he knew exactly what word he was giving me. He knew what he was telling me was important information. He knew what to say to help jog my memory. I had that recorded. He escorted them door to door of all the witnesses. And he said, one thing that I was upset with him about, he said he thought my father made a mistake in not letting them talk to me. I said, you gotta be kidding. I said, I was 12 years old. I said, there was no way those men were going to talk to me. I said, my dad would have killed him. Would have killed him in a minute. I just want to tell you a little bit about who Police Chief Liebegall is. We're not just talking about any man. He was born the 4th of July. 1920. He fought in three wars, Korean, World War II, and Vietnam. He passed the bar exam in Michigan with a concentration on foreign language. He was an interpreter for German prisoners. He was the first chief, police chief, to set the stringent rules of a four-year degree, and only those with great integrity and high moral values were considered. In the year of 1960, he was the police chief of two towns 300 miles apart, Sheboygan, Michigan, and Novi, Michigan. Google him. He was a father to me. Hours and hours of conversation. He was also my friend. We needed each other. He never married and he never had children. He had one true love and she died. The last time I saw him was in his coffin, March 8th, 2020. I was never able to give him the book that I dedicated to him. But I know that him and Cindy are with me. And my life continues to be filled with these chapters of my life, this high strangeness.
Wow. Beautiful. Talk about some of the paranormal stuff you were mentioning with the, because that does happen with experiences, that once you have the event, then high strangeness starts to happen around you. So describe some of that stuff.
Yes.
Especially dead people stuff, because Whitley Strieber will bring that, you know, Whitley Strieber's story that when he wrote Communion, his wife came out of the room after reading 200,000 letters and said, "Whitley, whatever we're dealing with has something to do with death." So talk about the paranormal and the necromancy stuff that you're talking about.
The necromancy, I'm going to tell you, I had an event with my grandmother in the 1980s after she died, my mother's mother, Mimi. And this was long before I awakened. And it was mid-afternoon, and I was living a really wild life. And Mimi was very strict Catholic. And we'd always argued. I always argued with her about the Catholic Church and priests and Catholic religion. And when she appeared to me, she was from the waist up and she was in her 40s. But when she died, she was in her 70s. And I've heard a lot of people say that when they have these, they always appear to be about 40. And she looked beautiful. Her skin was glowing. She looked healthy. And I said, "Mimi, there really is a heaven." And she said, "Yes, but not as you know it." The pencils, and she used the word pencils, the pencils here are long and sharp. And the reason she used the word pencils is because pencils can be sharpened and things can be erased. So we can atone for the things we do here. And she was telling me to change my life and get it together.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, it's really funny because I said I did not have a close relationship with my mother. I always felt she didn't love me. I always felt that. And she told me once, she said, "There is no law that says a mother has to love their child." And I told one of my therapists that, and she said that was really, really, well, I won't even say what she said, but she swore.
And you have a lot of messages, contacts. I always ask you, I've made you tell the story numerous times about when you ask whether he was an alien or whether they're aliens. That I'm always interested in.
Yes. You had asked me to ask, and I always get answers from the questions I ask them, not when I want them. I want them right away. Yeah. But I was told, we are not alien to this planet or any planet, as we have always been here. I want to talk about the samadhi. There are so many definitions for samadhi, but my favorite one is, and then I'll give you an example that I had of samadhi. was Samadhi is awakening from the dream of your character in the play of life. Both the actor and the audience are realized, end quote. Now, in the summer of 2018, I was walking in my park, which I spent a lot of time in that park. I wrote my books between, much of both of my books, between two trees. But as I was walking, I felt this separation from my body. And it was a disconnect, and I was weightless. I actually felt myself rising out of my body, and I was at tree level. And I was watching Nancy, me, walking from behind. And I thought to myself, you really are little. I thought how tiny I looked. And then it was only the second that I started to wonder. It was only when I became conscious that I wasn't in that body, that I was quickly thrown back into it. So that is what samadhi is, when both actor and audience are realized. And that is exactly what happened to me. An example of awakening, long before we made animals pets, we had to slowly assimilate them into our lives. And this is what the ETs are doing with us. They are slowly assimilating themselves into our lives. And people like you and people that are awakened, you know, we're the ones that are getting all of this information. And it's for the awakened ones. And one of the messages they told me in the very beginning, our messages are not for everyone. Many will be left behind. And then I'm given visions that are put in my head over and over again, like the old slide projectors. And I can't see beyond the vision. And so I made to draw them. And the one I drew in 2015 was, I'm standing amid, and it's in the book, of all of these beautiful ships, rods, and orbs. And I'm crying. I'm crying because feel so much love. And the beauty is breathtaking of all of these. And this is something that's going to happen. This is actually going to take place. And I'm saying, thank you. Thank you. It's gratitude. They've come. And I told Linda Moulton how about this. They've come to take in the awakened.
What do you think their main message for the world is? What do they want us to grow up and learn, or learn, or why are they here?
Well, this is Earth School, and everyone is here for a purpose. And I am so glad that I found out what my mission was. And I'm atoning for all the bad things that I did, because I did a lot. And I've spent the last, I call myself since 1986, September 23rd, 1986 is when I turned my life around really became a good person. I've always been very over empathetic. I cry at everything, every commercial, everything makes me cry. But yeah, everybody's here for a reason and a mission. And it's not supposed to be all fun and good and games, you know. And I'm living the way I'm living by choice. I certainly don't have to live as a pauper. I could have gotten married several times to, you know, but I choose to do what I'm doing right now. If I was in a relationship, it would hinder me. And it's not time, but I will. And it's odd because I actually know the person, the name of the person that I'm going to end up with.
Uh-oh.
And it's weird because I was on a plane And I was sitting next to a gorgeous guy, and he told me his name, and it was the name that I was told. And I thought, this must be him. And I'm flirting away with this guy, because this has got to be the guy, right? And he's telling me about, and then he starts telling me his girlfriend. He's flying to see his girlfriend. So I realized that this isn't the right one. But we're here to learn. And everybody's got things to contribute. And mine is what I'm doing right now, sharing my information and my messages that can only be understood by people like myself, who's experienced it. I know a lot of people are thinking, oh my God, she's crazy. I'm not crazy. I have very high IQ. I'm intelligent. I'm honest. And you know, I wanted to take a lie detector test. When this first began, that's all I talked about. Give me a lie detector test. Now, when I saw what they did to a very famous,
yes, I know what you're talking about.
I said, there's no way. Yeah. No way. Yes, because they tried to take this person down.
Do experiences come to you? Have you had to tell me some stories about people?
Oh, who yes.
For support.
I get emails all the time. In fact, I just got one. A lovely a man who actually thought that I had the ability to heal his wife, his cancer. And he said, could you help my wife? And I said, what's wrong with her? And he said, she has cancer. And I said, I'm not a healer. I said, I can pray for her, but I'm not a healer. And if an experiencer tells you that they can heal your wife, run, run. When I get these messages, and I always write them down as quickly as I can. And I started getting them after the third regression, these messages started coming to me. And I knew they were coming from a place of love. I didn't know who was giving me these messages, but I knew they were coming from a place of love. And they are upgraded. We're being upgraded. You know, that's the purpose of the hybrids is we are being upgraded. But we certainly need to be upgraded because of the emotion of empathy. You know, all the studies that have been done, and empathy is waning so much. People are angry. I mean, just go to the grocery store and look around you. Watch, and on the road, the way they drive, people are mad, they're angry. We've really gone downhill, and they're very concerned about this. Where did I read it? The kids got a hold of the matches, you know, when the hydrogen bomb. And I'm very good friends, I'm gonna drop a name. I have become very good friends with Dr. Carol Rawson. We are like sisters. In fact, we call each other sis. She says, you're in the wrong forum. You gotta get out of there. You gotta get away from these people. Your information is positive. And
But again, the message you were told, the message is not for everybody. You put it out and whoever needs to hear it will hear it. They'll be led to the
yes. Message, correct? What Carol does, I'm intimidated by her actually. She's so intelligent. She's such a beautiful soul. And works and still works so hard at de-weaponizing space, you know. She went to 100 countries. She's visited 100 countries and spoken. And she said almost every leader wants to sign this. this treaty against the weaponization of space, but not the United States. Oh, no. But everybody else, even Russia, Putin. You know, we don't hear what's really going on here, you know.
But that may be why you and I are here. It's like I always say to people, you're here. If reincarnation is a fact, you came here at this time, in this place, in the middle of whatever mess we think we're in, and perhaps we're here for a reason.
You're right. And this is wonderful. We are here at a historic time, 2020, you know, 2020 meaning perfect vision. And it is. 2020 gave a lot of perfect vision to a lot of people. You know, to realize that these material things aren't so important, you know, that they were all locked in just like everybody else. They lived just like everybody else.
Does Mister have future plans for you? Are you doing a third book? Can you talk about what you think he's directing you to do now?
Yeah, I am going to do the third book, yes. Like I said, the second book is a new title, new cover. Did you get your book, by the way? It's sent over a month ago to you.
It takes a long time from the States. No, I haven't got it yet, but I appreciate
it. New cover, new title, new chapters, deleted chapters in the other one, new chapters. It's beautiful read now. Grammar, it's like a new book.
You're very detailed in terms of your books and the way you track things down. You don't leave any stone unturned.
No, and I think that's why where I'm headed right now is I'm still researching and I'm still Nancy Drewing and I still have a lot of things to uncover, and that's where I'm at right now.
I will have to make sure that I get you some lectures and get you out there. And hopefully Whitley does the interview, because Whitley is sort of one of the key experiencers that will understand your story.
I had an interview with him.
Oh, you did? Good.
A couple years ago. I don't know. It was years ago. And we were ready to go on and he wasn't there. And I have his phone number and I called him. And this was years ago. And I said, we have an interview. And he said, I am so sorry. He said, I've been so sick. And he said, let's reschedule. And we just never did. You know, I'm really not crazy about doing interviews. I really truly believe that my purpose is as a public speaker, because I need the energy from the audience. I also am able to say what I want to say without... because everything has to be in order. I mean, in my apartment, in my cupboards, everything is perfect. Colors, everything, you know, everything is scheduled perfect. Like my dad was like that. And I know what time I go on and I know what time I have get off. And that's my mission is, and I, when I was in Ozark, it wasn't me speaking. I watched that interview and I go, wow, you know, it was a good interview, but I was being helped, you know.
Yeah.
Cindy was there helping.
Well, I will help you do that. Just a funny story. I don't know if you've told this before, but when you were at my book table. So when it was finished, you had this huge lineup of all these people and you only had like 30 books and they were gone like right away. But all you were talking about is the guys who were trying to to talk to you. You're very popular there.
Yes, I met two. I'm still really good friends with one of them. He flew out here one time and he drove here another time. Nothing. But we're still really good friends. He's in a relationship now. And the other person wrote a book, and his name is Dave Shoup. Do you know who I'm talking of?
No.
See?
Yeah.
I'll have to send you his PDF, because he sent me, this guy's unbelievable. He's a genius.
Yeah.
And see, he's another one. You don't see him speaking. And this is someone you would love to speak with. He's so over my head. He's happily married. We've talked on the phone a few times, but he was one of the men that wanted to speak to me. But it wasn't to flirt with me, but although a lot of them did, but he knew I was telling the truth, and so did the physicist, you know, and the people in that audience that wanted to talk to me, they said, you know, we knew you were telling the truth, you know, and I'm talking about physicists and researchers and scientists. And I was like, wow, you know.
You tell a very powerful story with a lot of emotion that there's nobody could ever, I don't know how anybody could disbelieve, especially when I've heard your story so many times. And I don't know exactly what you're going to say next. You have it down, you know exactly. You've never altered your story. It's always been the same story. And it's been a very simple story. Even the thing where you didn't identify the fact that you were before Betty and Barney Hill. I didn't realize that until you talked to Jimmy Church. I didn't realize that.
I didn't say a thing because I didn't want to. I didn't want to take the light away from them. But that, see, I've always been a pleaser. I was always trying to make my mother love me. I wanted her to love me. And I would always ask my mom, Mom, if you had a choice and you had to have one of us kids killed.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And who would you pick? And she would say, oh, that's an awful question. That's terrible. But I knew who it would be. I just wanted her to say, you, Nancy. But my dad's love made up for it.
Wow. When did your father pass away?
And I always block the year out. I block it out. 1990. Isn't it odd? I just block it out.
Wow.
But shortly before his death, I said, my mother wasn't in the room. And I said, Daddy, am I too big to sit on your lap? And he said, no. Had in his lap and I sat on his lap. And I said, I just want you to know that I love you more than any daughter has ever loved their father.
Wow.
And he cried. And I remember my mother would yell at me because when I got pregnant, my dad had a heart attack. I was 17. She said, no, you make your father cry. And then she said something really silly. I can't even make him cry. Like I was trying, I can't even make him cry. But my mom and I had a very weird relationship. We were loved in order of accomplishments, looks, and education. And I was really an ugly baby. No, I really was. I mean, I show people go, no, and I show them pictures of me. I was an ugly baby. I had this gigantic looking head, and I was an ugly baby, and I was probably hard to love. And my mother took a job after I was born. And my Aunt Jeannie took care of me, her sister. So Aunt Jeannie was more like a mother to me, and she breastfed me because she had just given birth to her son. And she said, I gave you chocolate milk. I'm a chocoholic. And I was always closer with my Aunt Jeannie than my own mother. And I lived with Aunt Jeannie a couple of different times in life. And she loved me as much as she loved her own kids.
Wow. Finally, let me ask you, what kind of message would you want to leave for other experiencers? Say someone who's just come into it and doesn't really know where to turn and what's going to happen. You've lived this your whole life. You've come through the other end. You've written two books. You've sort of assimilated and it's become something that you would probably do over and over again every time you got a chance. So what would you say to them if they're lost and they're trying to figure out where do we go now? And why is it important that they try to get their story out?
I have to laugh because there's only one Sir Grant Cameron, because, you know, I direct them to you, you know, but there's only one you. They need to be heard. And you just have to keep reaching out. And, you know, you have to talk about it. You have to. You can't hold it inside. You know, it was killing me. It was killing me. I just saw my I'm telling things I never, I just saw my two granddaughters for the first time in since my grandson graduated 3 years ago. Wow. I just saw them a couple weekends ago. And I was welcomed by the oldest granddaughter. But the other one was very cold. I asked her if I could hug her. It was very difficult. I went into a deep depression after that. I wished I'd never gone to this event, but they were going to be there. And it was my ex-son-in-law, who I'm still very close with. He still calls me grandma.
That's something I don't think people realize, is that you gave up a lot for going with this. The same as Sherry Wilde had the same, and a lot of experiencers have that, where you'd think that the people that would be supporting you would support you, and you've not really made that public. I knew that story, that you've given up a lot to tell your story, that people,
and they know I'm telling the truth. This is what hurts so bad, is they know I'm telling the truth. Grandma's a lot of things, but grandma's never been a liar.
Yeah.
And they know that. And that's what hurts so bad. But.
Well, as I say, I applaud you for what you've done, and I guarantee you history will treat you properly.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, once it's out and people realize, and I feel sorry for you and others, that the UFO community is still ostracizing the experiencer. They want to hear stories about government cover-up. They want to hear all this other nonsense. But the people who are actually the people with the message are still being ignored. And I will do whatever I can to support you and to.
I appreciate you so much. And, you know, I've had so many beautiful people put in my path, the meant to be's. Jeff Dimmers, who published the Enlightened, and who cleaned up my recordings. And he's always there when I need him. And Doug Ault.
Oh, yeah. Let's go through that. We haven't mentioned that.
So
you have some bad stuff, but you also have some good stuff. Tell me what's going to happen with Doug Ault.
Well, Doug Ault is a famous artist. And he's written a musical, a Broadway musical titled Hypnata, which the word came to him as he was coming out of, it's that moment between sleep and wakefulness. And it's based loosely on Cindy and I, the two main characters, Nectar and Jelly. And it's for all age groups. There is no fear in it. But he addresses how difficult it is for experiencers to come forward and share their stories in the face of resistance. And the musical is just a beautiful, beautifully written. He's written every song, all the lyrics. Doug did this all himself. The man he's a genius. And I am honored that.
Not many people get a Broadway musical made about their story, that's for sure.
No, to be an artist's muse, I mean, come on. Yeah.
Have you got your dress picked out for opening night?
No.
Well, I'll be there with you.
But it's gonna happen.
I'll be there with you.
Yes, you will.
Then we can celebrate that, you know, because that's what it is. Like, I think they point out to you, it's not all good and it's not all bad. You have to live.
Yes.
Get dealt certain cards. You don't just get candy floss and stuff to eat all the time. And
oh, I still have a lot of the good stuff. I still get a lot of that. Yes. I've got my cat Joy, and I'll tell you, she is the joy of my life. And she knows when Mama does radio interviews, she knows. I gave her crab meat. She loves crab. I gave her crab meat, and I said, "Now you better be a good girl." So she's at my feet right now, not making a move.
There you go. Although she did sort of freak out Jimmy Church.
Yeah, she was walking behind the blinds. Yeah, he was watching the blinds moving. Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, so I will do what I can to promote you, and we'll get together. We'll definitely be at the Broadway musical when it opens.
Yes, we will.
And we will. I will make sure you get a lecture somewhere, because you are one of the most dramatic, moving lectures I've ever heard in my life, bar none. I mean, it was unbelievable, and everybody else in the room thought it as well. So you're an extremely good speaker, and we'll get something worked out in that, because I've got some connections, and we'll make it happen.
I love you, Sir Grant. I truly love you.
Beautiful. Thank you. Oh, yes. And my little alien. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.